Fire system let loose any minute now, because everything's just gone wrong. And but through perseverance, we'll get through this together. This is a different talk for me, and for a couple reasons. One, when I was working on it and talking about it at work, I had a whole bunch of people asked to read it. So it's slightly different because I referenced a lot of profane history more than what I was planning on, in the sense that I wanted to back up everything that I was saying, because the people I'm going to be giving this to don't have a clue who John Thomas is and Robert Roberts. And one of the things I did is I didn't cite every time I quoted them. But bear in mind, most of this talk, as the preceding talks, have been based upon their works, and I'm assuming everybody can accept that as a statement that a lot of this comes from their works, and some of it's paraphrased and some of it's not. But I won't mention them every quote. One of the things about using profane history that amazed me is that it shows the Bible to be true, even at times when it was thought to be legend. A lot of the stuff that I'm going to be discussing was always thought to be legend, and yet it's not, and people are believing it because different kings are writing about the same event, and they're writing about it from their point of view, which adds the veracity to the scriptures. So this morning, we're come together to consider some thoughts about Persia. It's an ancient empire, and as you can see from the slide up here, I thought it was an interesting, I couldn't work it into the talk, so I used it for my opening slide. It's an interesting slide. They believe that they have the tomb of Daniel, which, who knows, and it's, but that is Susa or Sushan, where Daniel did spend some time. Persia is an ancient empire. It's been in existence a long time. It was in existence before Abraham. It's one of the few nations that God has allowed a continuous existence. It's been in existence since the grandson of Noah. It was originally settled by one of the sons of Shem. If we look at Genesis chapter 22, we see that the children of Shem were Elam and Asher and Arphaxad and Lud and Anram. There is very little geography given in Genesis, but if we consider the names, we find the same person being given a geographical area, which is basically where they settled. Arphaxad, we learn from the histories that the children of Shem populated the Middle East. Our subject under discussion was from Elam, or was Persia, which came from Elam. Assyria descended from Asher, and Mesopotamia from Aram. And when we follow it down farther, we see in Genesis chapter 10, we see the lineage of Noah being given. I guess we don't see the lineage of maybe we won't see the lineage of Noah being given, because maybe I didn't put it on there. Anyway, Shem was the last person to be reported. If you open your Bibles and turn to chapter 10, it's just as good as looking up there anyway, maybe even better. And one of the reasons I think Shem being the last was because his lineage continued down through Abraham to Christ. Unfortunately for me, the scope of this talk doesn't follow Shem, who begat Arphaxad, who is in the line of Abraham, who is in the line of Christ. It follows Elam, Arphaxad's brother. Elam, according to Brown Biggs Driver, Hebrew definition, signifies eternity. And basically, if you think about it, God has allowed Persia to exist for almost the entire state of man, which we would consider eternity. Elam is located in Iran. It doesn't take the present-day whole area of Iran. It just kind of takes the lower area right around down in here. That's how it starts out. It's one of the, as I said, it's one of the oldest recorded civilizations. And it's been around since 3200 BC. From 2700 BC to 539 BC, man calls it the Proto-Elamite period. And the reason I'm saying this, I have a graphic on there that lists the whole history of Iran, and we just haven't got to it yet. When you can see up there, Susa, which was became the capital of the Elamites, early on began to influence the culture around that little Iranian plateau. Ancient Elam lay to the east of Sumer, and as somebody was saying, they butchered the names. Welcome to, we're in the same world. I have total ability to butcher a name, so we're going to do that just as much as we can here. So those of you that want to correct me afterwards, please, I won't remember, but you could try. I hate giving talks off of the computer because things always tend to go wrong. I like paper, but when I went over to print it out, I put my drive into the business center's computer and crashed it immediately. Twice. So, in the old Elamite period, it consisted of kingdoms of the Iranian plateau centered in Askan, founded in the second millennium BC. Like we said, it was right around Susa, and a word I'm not even going to say. The culture played a crucial role in the Persian Empire, especially during the, I was corrected on this twice already, Achaemenid dynasty that succeeded it, which the Elamite language remained in official use. Most Iranian scholars consider the Elamite period as the starting point for the history of Iran. Although the language is not related to any current Iranian language, it's part of a larger group of languages used in that area. Elam is still a province in modern-day Iran. So if you take that thought and chew on it for a little bit, it means Elam's been around for a really long time because it's mentioned in the Bible with Noah, and it's still a province in Iran. At the time of the book of the Genesis was written, Madai, the son of Japheth, the son of Shem, the son of Noah, ruled northern Iran. Scholars have identified Madai with the various nations from early Mitanni to the much later Medes. These people reckoned to be his offspring were the first known Madai in the Assyrian sources as well as Hebrew ones. It is the names by which the Medes are known on Assyrian monuments. The reason I'm telling you that is the Assyrian monuments become a very important part of this talk. A scholar by the name of Mr. George Smith, who I don't know, I can't think of the name. He actually knew a friend of Brother Robert's, and they corresponded back and forth. I can't think of the friend's name right now. I didn't write it down. Anyway, he was with the British Museum, and he made a significant discovery and wrote several articles for the Nature magazine and a few books showing some of the earliest events recorded in the Bible histories. Or about the Bible recorded in profane history. His writings are still quoted, are still in use, and as seen in this article that I'm going to quote from, The History of Freemasonry by Albert Mackey, which was written in 1998, he's still being quoted as a scholar, His books are still for sale on Amazon.com. So, you know, if you really get interested in this and you want to see it, George Smith, and like I said, he made a discovery, and basically that's what we're going to talk about here. In the latter part of the 19th century comes a learned scholar, I'm quoting from the History of Freemasonry, well acquainted with the language of ancient Babylonians and Assyrians and with complicated cuneiform alphabet which it is clothed, and visiting the remains of ruined cities which Nimrod had built, finds fragments of 12 tablets which contain a history of the Babylonian monarch to whom he gave the provisional name as Izdubar, who was later identified with Nimrod. If this identification be correct, and there is certainly a strong internal evidence in favor of it, we have in these tablets a somewhat connected narrative of the exploits of the proto-monarch of Babylon, which places his character in a more favorable light than which it had hitherto been received, as the popular beliefs founded on the statements of Josephus and of several other Oriental traditions. Now, this same document that he's quoting from, and he goes on to quote a little bit more, the same document chronicled what happened during the time of Abraham, which the Bible records in Genesis chapter 14. That's correct, I'm wrong. In Genesis chapter 12, basically, you can read along as we go. I'm not going to read the whole quote, but basically, Mr. Smith says, its resemblance to the biblical narrative is striking, yet neither has the appearance of being drawn from one from the other, and most rational conclusion is that they are independent accounts of a real event in human history, of which the ancestors of both nations had an experience. The next event in Bible history, which the Assyrian records illustrates, is the invasion of Palestine in the lifetime of Abraham by a powerful monarch who bore sway over lower Mesopotamia, but whose proper country was still the more remote Elam, or the tract of east of the lower Tigris, between its course and mountains. It is surprising to find that at this early date, military expeditions could reach so far, and as first a strange sight that a power so little known as Elam should have been a cheap invader. The early Babylonian inscriptions show, however, that Elam did at a remote period exercise authority over lower Mesopotamia, and the monarchs of the Elamite race did carry their arms to Syria. If we look at the account on the screen, we find that five Canaanite kings, Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zebon, and Bela, which is also called Zoar, have been subject to Kedorlaomer for 12 years. I got that one right. I want you to know. Practice. Kedorlaomer, sorry, I was close. We look at the map and peruse the territories involved, we find that Elam had become a very large and powerful nation. Abram had been sojourning in the land for about 10 years when the five kings who were in their 13th year of subjection rebelled against Kedorlaomer. He, with the assistance of the king of Shinar and Eleazar, and Tidal, the king of nations, began to overrun the land. I tried to find some information out about Tidal, the king of nations, and pretty much came up fairly blank on that. They overcame five kings and put them to flight. But while they were overrunning the land, Sodom was attacked and taken. We know that Lot dwelt in Sodom, and he was taken along with his goods and when the spoil of the city was carried away. In the 13th verse, we read of Abraham hearing of this. And there came one that escaped and told Abraham the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite, the brother of Eshcol, the brother of Aner, that these were confederate with Abraham. And when Abraham heard this, he armed his trained servants, about 318 people, and started off in pursuit of Kedalaomer. And when he reached Dan, he either caught up with them, or he reached an area for which he had a plan of attack. I've read some serious debates about that. According to the Assyrian account, he used a tactic which is in use by the Bedouins today. He had his men attack the rear of the camp at night, and then when the confusion was at its greatest, he came in from one of the sides, and he chased them at that point in time unto Hobah, which is west of Damascus, where he freed Lot, recovered the spoil, and started to return south. You were looking at the Bible account, I was reading the Assyrian account, and they follow pretty closely. It's interesting to see that match up. We encountered Elam a few more times in the Bible, but it's usually in genealogical listings. Elam is mentioned in Isaiah chapter 11, which I hope to get to in a little later on, depending on the time frame of how things are going. When we search through the profane history, we find Elam in a series of war and eventually overcome by Babylon. Looking at the 21st chapter of Isaiah, the Bible tells us that it was associated with Media and Isaiah's prophecy against Babylon. This was nearly 200 years before the events spoken of took place. Isaiah had a grievous vision of the siege in Babylon by the Medes and the Persians. In verses 3 and 5, wrong one again. And he speaks of it from the very point of view of the king of Babylon at the siege. Therefore are my loins filled with pain. Pangs have taken hold upon me as the pain of a woman that travaileth. I was bowed down at the hearing of it. I was dismayed at the seeing of it. My heart panted, fearfulness affrighted me. The night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear unto me. Prepare the table, watch in the watchtower, eat, drink, arise ye princes, and anoint the shield. Both profane history and the scriptures tell us of Belshazzar's feast. Daniel in chapter 5 gives a divine account, and the 6th verse tells of the great fear that the king had. And the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loose, and his knees smote one against the other. The end of this chapter tells of Daniel's prophecy and the king's demise. This is the writing that was written, meaning, tinkle, and farson. This is the interpretation of the thing, meaning, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tinkle, thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, the kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet, and put a chain of gold around his neck, and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. The death of Belshazzar was also prophesied in Jeremiah 25, verses 12 and 13. It shall come to pass, when 70 years are accomplished, I will punish the king of Babylon, and that nation, saith the Lord, for their iniquity, and the land of the Chaldeans, and will make it a perpetual desolation. And I will bring it upon that land all my words which I have pronounced against it, even all that is written in this book, which Jeremiah had prophesied against the nations. We find the 70 years accomplished at the death of Belshazzar. In an article on Daniel by Brother John Thomas, we have the times of the King of Babylon's listed. He wrote, "The occupation of the throne as a member of the Golden Dynasty had been limited to the 70th year from the first of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, and the 70 years were filled up by Nebuchadnezzar's reign of 44 years. Evil-Merodach 2 years, usurpers of 4 years and 9 months, Belshazzar's grandson Nebuchadnezzar of 19 years and 3 months. Scriptures take no notice of the usurpers. I have therefore divided the 26 remaining years after the death of Nebuchadnezzar into the 37th years of Jehoiakim's captivity between Evil-Merodach and Belshazzar in my chronology at the end of Eureka Volume 2. It's interesting to note Matthew Henry, you guys may recognize some of these names, you may not. John Wesley and Dr. John Gill are in agreement with the 70 years begin with Nebuchadnezzar and ends with the death of Belshazzar. Now this transfer of government occurred in 539 BC. And it had a mission. The mission was to destroy, was to restore Judah's commonwealth. God, through Isaiah, names successor. He says, "Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue the nations before him, I will loose the loins of kings to open before him 2 lead gates, and the gates shall not be shut." That's a relief of Cyrus, supposedly depicting him. Again, that's don't know for sure. That's just what the historical sites were saying. I thought it was a neat picture, so I used it. Don't hold me to any of these pictures being exactly what they say they are. You just never know nowadays. The edict by which Cyrus fulfilled the prophecy is recorded in Ezra chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, and the events described in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah supplying the detail of the partial return of the Israelites to Palestine, and the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the temple, the setbacks and the difficulties caused by local opposition and the changing moods of the Persian monarchs. We find Persian history also records the decree of the return of the Jews in the Koresh prism. When I was practicing this talk, Sister Becky made a face when I read what came off the Koresh prism, and she kind of hinted that I should paraphrase what is being said. So basically what I'm going to paraphrase instead of reading it, and it says that I am Cyrus, the great king of the world. My father was great, but I am greater than he. My grandfather was great, but I am greater than my grandfather, and greater than my father still. And he goes back through his lineage and finally comes up and says, I come from a line of great kings, and I am greater than all of them. Not that he didn't have much of an ego or anything. He says that my God is the greatest God, but in endeavoring to worship him, I decided to return to the sacred cities on the other side of Tigris, the sanctuaries that had been in ruin for a long time, because I was worried about the... He doesn't say it exactly this way, but basically he says, because I was worried about the other gods being mad at me. Well, if you read the biblical account, you really know why he did it, and he's not necessarily going to tell the truth on this inscription, but he's given us the basis of what happened. And he basically says that he returned a whole bunch of people unharmed with their formal temple supplies because he didn't want to anger the other god, even though his god was the greatest. I really enjoyed that part of it. During these events, the Persians were engaged in further conquests, still extending their dominion, that the Persian Empire became the second world empire, which is represented by the breast and the arms of Nebuchadnezzar. It's image and by the bear in Daniel chapter 7, verse 5, where it says, "And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised itself up on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh." Well, that was pretty much the policy of the Persians. Arise and devour much flesh. They conquered a lot of people. The bear was a symbol of this government, whose dominion extended from India to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. I think I have a map coming up next, but I don't really remember. Nope. Sorry. It's huge. This change of position, the reign of the bear began with a Mede. Yeah, that's basically, thank you. That's basically the territory, and if you see, it is a fairly large area. After it began under a Mede, 2 years passed, and then it became the inheritance of Cyrus the Persian. And this change is represented by Daniel, where he says the bear raised itself up on one side, so that one side was greater than the other. And therefore, the higher side acquired its position last, as appears in the history of the time. If we look at the 8th chapter of Daniel, which I didn't put on there, but the horns of unequal height are the same symbol for the same government, and the unequal elevation of the rams means the same thing. The higher horn came up last. We note the three ribs in the bear's mouth between its teeth, the ribs represented a threefold division of its conquest. The interpretation is found elsewhere in the words of Daniel. It pleased Darius, or Darius. I just found out I've been saying Darius all my life, and I was corrected and said it's Darius. So if I switch back and forth, I'm sorry, I'll get confused real easy. To set the kingdom, 120 princes who should be over the whole kingdom, and over these three presidents, whom Daniel was the chief, and the princes might give account to them, the king, or the bear mouth, should have no damage. The three presidencies, then, are the silver dominion, or the ribs in the mouth of the bear. In dismissing this symbol, it's worthy to remark that while the ram is a symbol of the Persians in Daniel's time, in the latter day history, as Brother Jim was pointing out, they become part of the bear dominion, or the Gogian host, and they changed their symbol, which we'll look at that aspect a little later. We find Daniel in the first year of Darius the Mede speaking of the Persian kings. And he says, "There shall stand up," in Daniel chapter 11, verse 1. I think that's the next one, yeah. he says, "There shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all." By his strength and through his riches, he shall stir up against all the realm of Grecia. Now, history records the names of these kings as Cambyses and Smerdis and Darius the son of Hystaspes and Xerxes. Cambyses was the son of Cyrus the Great, who revolted from the rule of Darius, defeating him and becoming the monarch of Persia. That happened about 529 B.C. And the reason I read four names there is because he killed his brother, Smerdis, in order to gain an unchallenged rule. He invaded Egypt about 525 and sacked Memphis and a couple other towns that I'm not going to try and pronounce. And his further plans for the conquest of Africa were frustrated. And at home, an imposter claiming to be the Smertus raised a revolt. And so Cambius died, possibly by suicide, while he was putting down the insurrection. The Smertus, who was the imposter, or may have been the imposter, ruled for a very short time. Darius states in the Behistun inscription that the man he had now succeeded was not the real Smertus, who claimed he was killed before Cambyses set out for Egypt, and that a rebel lookalike named Gameta. There is a strong possibility he is an imposter, because if you look at the scriptures, it takes no notice of imposters. And there's three kings listed, and there's only three kings that come up, even though he ruled for a couple of years. This Darius, the son of Hystaspes, did many great things for Persia, including giving the Persian Empire its two official capitals, one at Susa, called Sushan in the Bible, and one at Persepolis. Well, there they are. I forgot about that one. Anyway, let's do it again. And Xerxes is Ahasuerus of the Book of Esther. And it may be observed from the opening verse of Esther, which may be observed from the opening book of Esther, Persia was at the zenith of its power. The map Jimmy had up showed it as at its strength, its strongest point, when it covered everything. But God was trying to, or starting to stir a rival and about to bring her to her knees. And we note that the quote in the second verse, by his strength through all his riches, he stirred up all the realm of Grecia. But Xerxes sent an expedition against Greece, which proved very disastrous for the Persians, although the time had not yet come for the Greeks to overthrow them altogether. To avenge Darius' defeat by the Greeks at the Battle of Marathon, he spent 3 years raising a massive army and navy. He acquired a lot of wealth. And when a storm destroyed bridges he built to cross over to the Hellespont, he had them rebuilt for 7 days and oversaw the crossing of his army. 360,000 troops and 700 ships. Unfortunately, they lost their navy, and he left to come back and left his army, which was defeated without him. Xerxes was then succeeded by his son Artaxerxes, the king who is so friendly towards Ezra and Nehemiah, and who is, apart from purely chronological references, the last Persian monarch referred to in the scriptures. Under the successors of Artaxerxes, the empire rapidly decayed and altogether collapsed when Alexander the Great invaded it. From this time, Persia ceases to have any connection with the land of Israel, and consequently, we don't find too much about it in the Bible either. Nevertheless, it was never entirely obliterated, like the Hittites, the Babylonian, or Assyrian empires. When Alexander, well, that's another picture of Artaxerxes. Just put it in there. There's the history of Iran, of all the dynasties. It's interesting to note that just for historical aspect, each one of those dynasties is a king. Never a family, just a king. Each king had his own little dynasty as we get down to the different dynasties. After Alexander's death, the Greek Empire was broken up, and various kings and empires rose and fell in Persia. About sometime after AD 26, Zoroastrianism became the main religion of the area. About 650 AD, Persia was conquered by Islamic Arab armies, which Jimmy touched on a little bit in his talk. Actually, he touched on it quite a bit. I'm going to touch on it a little bit. This began the spread of Islam in Persia. But about 600 years later, in AD 1219, they got to face one of the most feared conquerors in the history of man, the legendary Genghis Khan. And Persia became a division of the vast Mongol Empire. In AD 1500, there was a rebellion, and a new Persian Empire was founded, whose boundaries spread until it was halted by the Ottoman Empire. War with the Ottomans became a fact of life in Iran. And during this time, the people became followers of Shia Islam. Jimmy touched on the differences between the different factions in Islam. It soon became the largest Shia country in the Muslim world, which is a position that it still holds today. In 1772, Russia and the Ottomans attacked the Persians. Neither Russia or the Ottomans gained any territory, but it weakened them so that in the late 18th century and the early 19th century, they were unable to withstand the European colonial empires. Though it was never directly invaded, it became dependent upon Europe. And this sets up our modern-day Iran. The Anglo-Russian Convention of 1907 formalized the Russian and British spheres of influence. At the same time, Muhammad Ali Shah Qajar granted a concession to William Knox Darcy, which later became the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. Production was started in 1914, and Persia was drawn into World War I because of its strategic position. In 1925, Reza Shah seized power and established a new dynasty, which was the last Persian monarchy before the establishment of the Islamic Republic. 1935, Iran was officially accepted as the new name of the country. But in 1953, Persian scholars protested, and the Shah announced that both the names, Iran or Persia, could be used. And now we come to modern-day Persia. Despite the economic growth and budding prosperity, there was much opposition to Muhammad Reza Shah because of how he used the secret police. On January 16, 1979, after much turmoil, he left Iran. On April 1st, after a landslide victory in a national referendum, where only one choice was offered. He had a great victory, but they only offered you one choice. You want this to be an Islamic Republic, yes or no? So naturally, the Ayatollah Khomeini won, and he formed a new republic with a constitution reflecting his ideals of Islamic government. And that's how modern-day Persia was formed. We might wonder what's in store for the future of Persia. The Bible gives us a pretty good clue if we look at the 38th chapter of Ezekiel. This chapter is a fundamental prophecy of the time of the end. I see I got another one in there, huh? Right? Nope. Well, I meant to put that up when we were talking about modern day Iran. This is kind of interesting because that little, as you can read in there, that little tulip in the center is the symbol for can't think what it's called. The guys that commit suicide. I forget what they call it anyway. That's the symbol for people who martyrdom. That's the word I'm looking for. It's right up there on the screen. Anyway, and the lines there, the funny looking scribble is actually Persian script saying God is great. So that's the current Iranian flag, or the current Persian flag. Back in store for what happens in Ezekiel, though. This chapter is restricted basically to the time of the end, and it's contemporary with the return of the Messiah. This chapter tells us three important things. One, Gog will insult somebody. It tells us who's going to be with Gog, and who will be attacked. So when we look at these verses 2 through 8, we see, son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. And say, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn thee back, and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and all thy army, horses and horsemen, and all of them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet. Gomer and all his bands, the house of Togarma, of the north quarters, and all his bands, and many people with thee. Be thou prepared, and prepare thyself, thou and all thy company that are assembled unto thee, and thou wilt be a guard unto them. And after many days thou shalt be visited, in the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword, and is gathered out of many people, against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. Well, it's pretty easy to pick out who Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya. Just look at a modern map and they jump right out at you. And I think we're all pretty well aware. I know they were well aware, even before Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts, that Arash and Meshech and Tubal were symbolic of Russia. But when you get to places like Togarma, that becomes a little more difficult. Togarma was the son of Gomer, the grandson of Japheth, the great-grandson of Noah. But there's little said in Scripture about him or his descendants. This prophecy, which was written in Babylon, says that the house occupies the parts of the north. In the northerly direction, then, from this junction of the Tigris and Euphrates, we must look for the territory occupied by Togarma's house. And this brings us to the country lying around the Caspian Sea. I think if you pop up, there's another map there. Yes. And if you look at the area, this map has a couple of really neat features to it. But all around the Caspian Sea, where there's Turkey and Iran and Armenia and Azerbaijan and Georgia and Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and Afghanistan and Pakistan. This map's also showing the Muslim population of the distribution. You can see the Shia and the Sunni. populations. So gives an idea to go ahead and kind of goes a little bit with Jimmy's talk a little more with the Muslim densities. So, anyway, the Scythians, oh man. If we actually, to kind of shorten this talk down, and Brother Thomas goes into this quite a bit in Eureka, and describes where Gog and the Magog comes from. And if you don't mind, I think I'll shorten this talk just a little bit and basically say, if you want to look at the area of Gog, kind of go starting right here in France, and you just kind of go around, and you cut through here, and you cut through here, and then you come up here, and you go through here, coming down through here, go down around through here, you come over here, you come up here, and you go up here, and you go all the way to the top, and you go all the way back to France. And that kind of sums it up in a real short and easy method to understand. I left my laser pointer at home, so. Basically, that's where it comes from, and Gog is a Gentile name, which is the only one to have figured in history. And it was put pretty simply in the exposition of Daniel on page 86 under the title of The Future Magnitude of Gog's Dominion. And speaking of the Gogian host, it explains the countries that will be comprised. Besides all of Russia, it will take in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Holland, Belgium, France, Spain, Portugal, Italy, Switzerland, Germany, Russia, Austria, Turkey, Persia, Tartary, Greece, Rome, and Africa, Egypt. This will be the dominion of a great magnitude, extending from the North Sea to the Wall of China, and Afghanistan, from the Ice Sea to the deserts of Arabia. This will include most of Europe. In the Middle East, most of Europe, well actually basically all of Europe, most of the Middle East, and parts of Africa. I kind of cut up through China because some of the places where I read, they included parts of China and parts of Mongolia. I'm not entirely sure, to be honest about it. This says the Wall of China, which is the edge of China, but in some other places I read where it came in a little bit farther. The next question on the agenda is who's going to be attacked. And that's from the 8th verse of the Daniel chapter. There's only one country that ever returned from the sword and gathered out of many people. Only one country that after nearly 2,000 years of non-existence returned to its former land. And for those of you who are going to correct me, I said nearly 2,000. I didn't say 2,000. In May of 1948, Israel became a nation, and the country which is against the mountains, and it is the country which is against the mountains of Israel. We find an article written over 150 years ago, and we're going to reproduce it here, which shows the accuracy of this interpretation of the 38th chapter. Robert Roberts, in the year 1865, wrote a series of articles entitled God's Purpose with the Jews, from which we now quote, "Adopting this course of pre-eventual restoration of Israel at once appears to be a necessity. Gog finds them in the land, brought back from the sword, gathered out from many people, and dwelling safely all of them. That is, before the advent, it is evident they possess much cattle and goods, and prosperously inhabit desolate places, but are nevertheless ignorant of God, and unaware of their moral relations to Him. They are evidently under the protection of another power, because they are without fortifications of their own. They are dwelling in careless prosperity, and when attacked are immediately befriended by a power having political preeminence. Gog is attracted by their wealth, which has apparently come by trading. They have gotten goods and cattle. It's a pretty good description of modern day Israel right now, under the protection of the United States and Britain. These events seem perfectly natural to the people around us, to man. The hand of God is only visible to those who are looking for it. We realize that God is in control. That's a thought we have to keep forefront in our mind, because we never know. We know we tend to walk around in life and forget just exactly how much absolute control God has in our lives. We are witnesses to a fact that Nebuchadnezzar had to learn the hard way, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and he set up over the basis of men, creating this confederation of Gog. The way things work out, it will be a perfectly natural circumstance. Problem is, we can't see exactly what's going to happen. We only have type and analogy. And this is not a precise application of exactly what's to come. I was discussing this with my sister wife, Becky, and I said, you know, hindsight's 20/20, but foresight's 120/120. It's a little difficult to see exactly what's going to happen. We know that there's going to be an interval between the arrival of Christ and the execution of judgment upon the oppressors. In our study of types and analogies, we realize that there is a time for the judgment seat, there's a time for the marriage supper of the Lamb, and then the time for the operations connected with the gradual approach to the Holy Land from the south. Christ's first work when he returns is the judgment, and I think everybody in this room is fairly well aware of that. There's lots of places in the Bible where we can prove that point, but I don't really want to get that far into that. I'd rather go a little farther to where the judgment involving that involves assembling the multitude of the living and the dead. And after they are set for, the judgment takes place, and the separation of all who do not belong to Christ. Though they are written in the book of life, they are brought to the judgment seat, those who do not belong to Christ, for sore punishment, in which the Lord will administer. And after this comes the marriage of the Lamb, and with those who are called chosen and faithful, and having their names written in the book of the life. There follows a gigantic honeymoon, a season of great joy and communion on the part of the multitude, admitted to immortal life and open fellowship with God. Think about it, brothers and sisters, total fellowship with God. But how long will this judgment take? Well, if we use the law of Moses for a shadow of things, skip that one. Didn't go there. Next one. Those are the verses proving judgment. Let's skip that one. Okay. Oh, you're right there. That's a good one. Thank you. How long will the judgment take? And we use the law of Moses for a shadow of things to come. Why shouldn't we? Christ himself says that Moses spoke of them. And he said unto them, these are the words which I spake unto you while I was yet with you, that all things must be fulfilled which are written in the law of Moses and in the prophets and in the Psalms concerning me. And if we look at the law, which speaks volumes about Christ, we can read from Leviticus chapter 25, verse 10, and ye shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto the inhabitants. And it shall be a jubilee unto you, and ye shall return every man to his possession, and every man to his family. We take those 50 years as the time for the proclamation and the destruction of Gog and the conquering of the nations and the marriage supper. We find from Joshua, and their children whom he raised up in their stead, them Joshua circumcised, for they were uncircumcised. This is when Joshua was bringing the children into the land. And it came to pass, when they had done this circumcising all the people, that they abode in their places in the camp till they were whole. And the Lord said unto Joshua, this day have I rolled away the reproach of Egypt from off of you. Wherefore the name of this place is called Gilgal unto this day. And if we can just flip one more real quick. That wasn't the one I was hoping for. One more. Nope. Go back to. Sorry. The verses I'm looking for aren't there. Sorry, I just erased my talk. You know, I fix these things, I just don't use them. When we look at this, this verse here, Joshua 5:7-9, and Brother Thomas and Chronicon and Breacon gives this period 5 years. This is the time that Joshua took to develop the land after coming in, after the circumcision, circumcision and the later on in the verses they hold the Passover feast. After this event, Brother Thomas and Chronicon and Breacon gives them 5 years till they take the land, and that's they keep the Passover and possess themselves of the inheritance. This is probably. And those of you who disagree, that's fine. I don't know how to say this, but there's a whole lot of different views out there. This is just the one I picked for this talk, because like I said, this is a very interesting subject, but there's a lot of different ways to look at it. And I know Brother Jim and I were talking about this earlier, and the differences in the different views. But probably when after the judgment and the marriage, and I think after the marriage it's probably going to be about a period of a year after the type of the in the law, when you get married you have a year where you don't do anything, basically you don't go to war. Well, at that time I think the saints are going to walk with Christ, walk with David, you know, walk with Job, pick somebody you think is going to be in the kingdom, and possibly have a conversation, walk around, spend a year getting to know one another. Then in that period of time, in that same year, if you look at the next verse, one of the things Moses did when he came into the land was he took the people, he took the elders, go ahead and flip it up one, Jim, would you please? Gather the elders of Israel, and they went over the plans of what was going to happen when they came into the land. Well, in that honeymoon period towards the end of it, I think that's what Christ is going to do, is go over his plans. So they have to be communicated to the saints, and you know, the rainbowed angel has to know how he's going to walk, even though we all have a pretty good idea. Christ has an exact idea of what he wants to do and how he wants to do it, so I think he's going to take some time and go through and do that. And then that period of 5 years begins, beginning the March of the Rainbowed Angel, which I think maybe I better quit, and not to say that I'm not going to go on a little farther, but Brother Jim covered it, and Brother Jim Hassel read quite a bit out of Eureka, beginning the march, and what's going to happen. He's going to come up out of Sinai, and he's going to head basically, he's going to bring in some of the Jews, and he's going to conquer the Arabs and turn them to become part of his battle group. And he's going to call in the Jews, bring in as many Jews as he can get, and start marching towards Armageddon, going through Basra. I don't have a map to show up there to point it out, but at that point in time, we hit Armageddon, and that's a whole other talk. I think somebody else has got scheduled. So that's kind of what I think. I know there's people here that's going to agree with that, and there's people that aren't going to know, and there's people that are going to vehemently disagree. Like I said, this is kind of like looking through dark glasses. This is just kind of what I think. And I showed you why, and gave you the verses thinking what I was thinking. And if anybody wants to talk afterwards, or anytime, I'm happy to talk about it. I'm not saying I'm 100% right. I'm willing to learn something, but this is events that are going to happen, and if we look at coming through the Exodus, we have the typical deliverance in the Mosaic law, and we have the antitypical when Christ comes. So there's going to be the antitypical deliverance of bondage, and the antitypical emergence from the grave, which is the Red Sea deliverance, or going through the Red Sea. The antitypical end of the wilderness journey. I mean, that's when man will sin, well, the saints will sin no more. And they will no longer be sojourning in the wilderness, basically. The antitypical circumcision at Gilgal, which was the last slide. Antitypical rolling away of the reproach of Egypt. The eating of the corn in the land. This is a fantastic period that we're thinking of. This is the time when Christ is going to start his rule, when he's going to bring about the end of the kingdom, or bring about his kingdom. That's the thing we're all waiting for. And it's something that's mind-boggling to contemplate. I think Brother Haskell said he could see the joy that Brother Thomas had in writing about it, and that's what makes it so mind-boggling, because I understand perfectly the joy he has. The only hope that we have is that we're there. So I appreciate everybody putting up with with my efforts here.